arrogant on his part. Well, it's Women's History Month. I went to my go-to KPFA, who are in pledge drive mode. I think it might be extended since they had unanticipated expenses, and I don't know how it happened, but anyway. So I've got an intersection of Black History Month and Women's History feature with Ida B. Wells, who's known for Chicago. I don't know if she has an honorary street or a real street named for her in Chicagoland. There should be one here, too. Gregory Carr is a big scholar of hers. He talks about how she intersects in time with, chronologically, with a number of people, such as Rosa Parks and a woman that was going to be on the $20 bill to get rid of Jackson, whose name is escaping me now. They were all alive for a moment at the same time. She also intersects with Frederick Douglass. In fact, I was curious to find this work that was released around the time of the Chicago Columbian Exposition, where it's a good summary of her work on Ida B. Wells being an investigative reporter, school teacher in Memphis, and then went on to be a journalist. And, I guess I made so many notes that that one is down in the mix now. She had a piece released, and Frederick Douglass actually wrote the first chapter of the book. Noting this, too, I think I mentioned this last week, International Women's Day is Monday. It seems like something very similar happened to May Day, to International Women's Day. In 1909, the first National Women's Day was observed in the United States on 28th of February. The Socialist Party of America designated this day in honor of the 1908 garment workers' strike in New York, where women were protesting against working conditions. I don't know if that dates back to the Triangle Shirtwaist catastrophe, but it might have, because that really ignited, if you will, the protest against working conditions. So it became internationalized and forgotten here in the U.S., which is how May Day happened, too. May Day started, I believe, in Chicago as a day for labor. All right. Coronavirus is a subject of both the commentaries, and I've been trying to sort some things out. A while back, I found an article, and now it's disappeared. I'm going to write the journal that it was in, or put up on the Facebook page a query to see whether that was a withdrawn article. It actually made the case that coronavirus was the development of it, and also these novel viruses come about because of animal husbandry in the factory farm mode, that the conditions are ripe for that kind of cross-species transfer in the kind of milieu that our food is being grown in. There's a lot circulating now around biological warfare sources of it, and it's gone around in a couple of circles, and I do not know what to make of it. Maybe you're hearing it here first for the first time, but try to investigate it. Francis Boyle, who has done a lot of work on chemical and biological warfare, is asserting that there's still 400 labs in the U.S. that are researching this in violation of treaties, which, not surprisingly, my Occam's razor on this was that it's much easier of a hypothesis to formulate that it was done in the way I suggested, the natural or sort of artificial occurrence, but and I didn't think that messing around with a coronavirus was a very good biological warfare element, just off the top of my head, no real science behind that. But now I'm discovering that weaponizing flu was actually being researched in some labs, according to some sources. So the way they use dengue fever in a couple of operations, particularly against Cuba, swine fever is still implicated possibly in that regard. makes it not entirely implausible, to use a convoluted triple negative, I guess. That's what it will. So already 5 minutes in, this tight schedule. It's a little... I also have something about religious extremists associated with Trump who are propagating something that goes beyond the Mexico City protocols, as it was called. I don't know if people go back to the Reagan era and remember how family planning money was taken away from clinics that even talked about. It was called the gag rule. We've got an acceleration of that, which is disinformation clinics that are being popping up. There was an internet, mainly in Latin America, as far as I know, but I think it was worldwide. Some activists, mainly women activists, got together and researched this by going underground. And there's a really good interview. So a couple of it's not a women's issue entirely, but women focused issue for today. But let's get to two regular features, again, both on Corona. I have a short segment, which I may not get to, from The Intercepted. They did a bunch of work having a little trouble here. Big Trouble in China is the name of this piece. And we'll just hear it in this way, I guess. Mui Abu Jamal, then we'll get back on track and get with Breaking the Sound Barrier with Amy Goodman.
Big Trouble in Big China. The novel coronavirus has brought the world's second biggest economy to a virtual standstill. That's because China is the workhouse of the West, where cars, computers, iPhones, clothes, and a wealth of other items gets constructed. China's labor force is the key to capitalist production of almost everything. And when it stops, as it has during the emergence of the coronavirus, almost everything stops as it ripples through economies worldwide. The U.S. economy lost trillions in 1 week on the stock markets. After NAFTA in the 90s, U.S. corporations fled abroad in search of ever cheaper labor. Mexico, Vietnam, China. China has a vast labor force and did a slew of deals that resulted in factories sprouting like mushrooms in the dark. The emergence of the novel coronavirus shows how closely we all work together in this new neoliberal world. And guess what? It ain't over. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Make your choice, Medicare or coronavirus for all. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. My coworkers make impossible choices daily because a lot of us don't have access to affordable health insurance. Those are the words of Vladimir Clerjean, a passenger service representative at JFK Airport in New York City. He was speaking at a training session Wednesday, learning to deal with the coronavirus COVID-19 epidemic. He said, "We choose not to see a doctor for a health problem because it could be the difference between paying the rent, taking care of family, or getting needed care." Earlier in the day, Vice President Mike Pence met with airline executives to discuss the crisis. Air traffic is still safe, they concluded. Yet it was reported on the same day that one of the growing number of coronavirus cases in Los Angeles County was a medical screener at Los Angeles International Airport. It wasn't clear if the illness was contracted at work or not. One thing remains certain. The coronavirus doesn't care how wealthy you are or what political party you're in. The best way to be sure the person next to you isn't sick is to make health care available to everyone. The best way to achieve that is through Medicare for All. The popular Medicare program, instituted in 1965, provides no-cost medical care for those 65 and older. Medicare for All would simply drop the eligibility age from 65 to zero, covering all Americans from birth. Our current health care system of private and nonprofit hospitals and doctor's offices would remain in place. Payments, however, would be made by the U.S. government, the single payer, replacing the for-profit health insurance corporations, which would essentially be put out of business. In presidential candidate, now Senator Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill, taxes would go up on the middle class and the wealthy, but onerous insurance premiums, deductibles, co-pays, and out-of-work expenses would go away. Health care costs would go down more than taxes would go up, except for the very wealthy. Most of Medicare for All's costs would be covered by eliminating the bloated overhead, profit-taking, and multi-million-dollar executive salaries of the health insurance industry. More savings would come from negotiating lower prescription drug prices, which Medicare is currently prevented from doing by law. Additional costs to society would be lowered or eliminated, such as the expenses incurred by millions of uninsured people who resort to emergency room visits that could have been avoided with preventive care and annual doctor visits. As the coronavirus pandemic spreads, it's in every individual's interest to know that all people have access to preventive and diagnostic care, as well as treatment if needed. You don't want to come down with COVID-19 because a person you were next to in some public setting couldn't afford a deductible or copay, didn't have paid sick leave, or is among the 37 million in the United States who completely lack health insurance. Last Monday, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo issued a directive requiring New York health insurers to waive cost sharing for coronavirus tests and related emergency room, urgent care, and office visits for those who already have insurance. He said, "Containing this virus depends on us having the facts about who has it," he said. He went on, "These measures will break down any barriers that could prevent New Yorkers from getting tested," unquote.
I'm going to amend the paid sick leave bill that I sent to the legislature to add a specific provision that says people who, because of this situation with coronavirus, have to be quarantined, should be protected, their employer should pay them for the period of quarantine, and their job should be protected.
But what about those who are uninsured? On Wednesday afternoon, Vice President Pence gave a press briefing, flanked by senior public health officials. At Monday's briefing, Pence pledged daily updates and full transparency. At Tuesday's briefing, the White House inexplicably banned video and audio recording. At the end of Wednesday's briefing, as Pence exited and with cameras once again allowed, a reporter asked about what happens to the uninsured. Katie Waldman Miller, Pence's press secretary, said, "Scream into the camera, it ain't going to get you anywhere. Listen carefully."
Can the uninsured get tested? Gentlemen, ladies, can the uninsured get tested?
Scream into the camera, it ain't going to get you anywhere.
Well, how about answering the question? That's a valid question. Could you answer it?
The question was ignored. Pence's press secretary, Katie Waldman Miller, married Trump's anti-immigrant senior advisor, Stephen Miller, 3 weeks ago. At New York City's major airports, workers like Vladimir Clerjean are represented by SEIU 32BJ. Wheelchair attendants, security cleaners, and passenger service representatives are demanding state government action to improve their health care plans, which currently make health care unaffordable with high premiums and deductibles, the union said. This is New York State Senator Alessandra Biaggi, who's just introduced the Healthy Terminals Act into the state legislature.
The Healthy Terminals Act is an attempt to really make sure that the people who are on the front lines of international travel at our airports, JFK, LaGuardia, Stewart Airport, have protection. During the Ebola crisis, these airport workers were only given a paper mask. We know that that is almost ridiculous because a paper mask will not prevent someone from getting Ebola. Here you have the security workers, the baggage workers, the wheelchair attendants, and the food and retail workers in our airports, the people who are doing the back-breaking work to make sure that our airports function and work are not protected under any insurance plan.
In 2018, President Trump disbanded the White House's pandemic response team and slashed the Centers for Disease Control funds for assisting other countries, including China, with epidemic prevention. We need a robust public health infrastructure. Above all, a healthy populace with regular access to affordable health care is the best defense against an epidemic like we now face. Medicare for All would give our national health care system a much-needed shot in the arm. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Sobering stuff, indeed. Well, I guess I'll point at the latest Intercepted, which they dropped on Tuesday, so they don't incorporate the results. 10 of 14 states for Biden. They have this guy, Li Fang, he has dropped a new article about this case in Texas where the lines were extremely long. I think it's the San Antonio district. Cuellar versus Cisneros. Cuellar's being funded by many groups, including, he's a Democrat, the Democratic primary. The Koch brothers dropped a lot of money on him, and so did Nancy Pelosi's fund for reelecting. Cisneros was seen as an insurgent along the lines of AOC. She is an immigration lawyer. She lost by a 4-point margin, and one wonders how close it could have been if there weren't long lines. Hopefully I have an election theft report from Greg Palast on this whole issue coming up. But in the meantime, I'm going to give it over to this somewhat of a women's history special, but there's a lot of African-American history, a lot of stuff that hits home, like the founding of the NAACP after what's called in this a race riot. It actually was an attack on a very bourgeois African-American community. There is some talk about how economics was the basis for a lot of the terror campaign against African Americans, but it wasn't explicit in the Springfield, Illinois case. Did have the usual pretext of a white woman being raped by a black man. It's a very insubstantial pretext, actually, it turns out. All right, we'll get right to this. This is from a show called Upfront. It's the special, though, for International Women's Day that the KPFA is doing. They do that every year, and I was looking for something, and this seemed apropos. Ida B. Wells, an investigative journalist, being lauded and connected to the rest of what was going on in the U.S. and in the activist community, particularly. Some real insights here, I think.
I'm Jeanine Etter. We continue our extended interview with Dr. Gregory Carr, Associate Professor of Africana Studies and Chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University. We speak about African-American investigative journalist, abolitionist, and suffragist Ida B. Wells, who led an anti-lynching crusade in the United States in the 1890s and being one of the founders of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And you were talking about her international reach, because her, yes, her work on lynching took her overseas to Europe on speaking tours about lynching, where she was educating people there about what was going on in the South, to their horror, because many people didn't know what was happening, and even people in the North as well in America.
Yes, you're absolutely right. She's spreading the message, raising awareness of the racial terror facing African people in the United States. And by doing it in Britain, of course, she's really extending, as I said, not only extending a tradition of doing that, she's linking those earlier movements to internationalize the plight of Africans in this country to the contemporary terrors that she and others were combating in the 1890s and beyond. Of course, the next figure we're gonna see emerge in that kind of internationalist phase will be another of her contemporaries, and that would be W.E.B. Du Bois, who in 1900 goes to England and to participate in the first Pan-African Congress, where you see black folk from the Caribbean, from the United States, a handful from Africa, Europe, come together to talk about this notion of building a solidarity movement to combat white supremacy on a global stage. And then, of course, finally, we'll see Ida Wells join with W.E.B. Du Bois and a handful of other black folk in a coalition with white liberals, white progressives in 1908. In 1908, they actually had a race riot in Springfield, Illinois, and that led in 1909 to the formation of a committee which gave birth to the NAACP. And the NAACP is very proud now to include Ida Wells as one of the founding mothers of the NAACP, which is kind of ironic because Ida Wells was always suspicious of white participation, white progressive participation in black causes, in some ways because, like another of her contemporaries, Carter G. Woodson, she was always suspicious of folks having motives that might not always sync with the black liberation struggle motives. So she's a complicated figure, and she often clashed not only with white progressives, but also with other black intellectuals and activists, sometimes around the issue of gender, oftentimes, however, on the issue of action, because Ida Wells, if nothing else, was, I guess at that time, they probably would have called her a militant voice, kind of, you know, an action-oriented intellectual activist. And that didn't always sit right with some of the men, really, in those small elite black circles.
Well, she had clashes with black leaders, but also with women in the movements, that she, like the suffragist movement. She had clashes with the white women that she was organizing with as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's funny when we think about it. There were so many formidable black women who participated in the suffragist movement. I think often when we cluster our analysis of social problems around categories like race or gender, I mean, there's a lot of talk now about intersectionality, race, class, gender. We disaggregate them in ways that don't reflect the lived experiences of the people who engage in social struggle. What I mean by that, and when Ida Wells is struggling for women to get the right to vote, she's very clear. I want all women to have the right to vote, but I'm struggling first as a black woman. Understanding that, if you go back to the 15th Amendment to the United States Constitution, one of the reasons that Sojourner Truth, a foremother of Ida Wells, raises the issue of her marginalization by some of these white women in this movement to acquire the right to vote. One of the reasons she raises it, because she says, I am black. And so when she gives the famous speech that we have received as Ain't I a Woman, even though she was a New Yorker and probably wouldn't have said ain't, Sojourner Truth is saying, yeah, I'm a woman, but I'm a black woman. And let's be very careful, because what we see in the history of the voting rights struggle in this country is that many of the white women, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, to name two, also had very, even as they were progressive for their time about race, I suppose, in the white community, they still had racism in their analysis. And in fact, it was very popular in the passage of the 15th Amendment to say, you know, these white women struggling for the right to vote, to say, don't give the vote to Sambo, meaning black men, before you give it to your wives and daughters. And so Fred Douglas, who was an advocate for women's rights, is torn, because he too is saying, we got to get this right to vote. So yes, black men get the right to vote with the 15th Amendment. Black women do not get the right to vote. However, what you see is black communities exercising the franchise often do so while black women and black men are having conversations before black men go pull the lever. Now it's time for the women's movement to continue as it matures and transitions to the next generation. White women, again, mounting this effort. We must have the vote. We must have the vote. Ida Wells joins with them, but she's joining with them as a black woman. So in the famous march here in Washington, D.C., during the Woodrow Wilson administration, when you see, and just before we get the passage of the 19th Amendment in 1920, what you see is Ida Wells joins in that movement. She joins in that movement, but when she joins in the movement, she does a couple of things. Number one, she's referring to herself as a race woman, meaning we're going to get this right to vote, but as a black woman, I'm doing this for the race, even as I am in a situational solidarity with these white women. And the other thing she refuses to do is she refuses to participate in a segregated march, because the march in Washington, D.C. was segregated by race. One of the ironies that she says, I'm going to expose this hypocrisy. So she refuses to march with the black delegations that are there. She
in the back, right?
In the back, right? They're going to put the Negroes in the back. Exactly right. And then she moves to the front, say, no, I'm going to march with my state. See, y'all playing games. And so when you go down to the Museum of American History, there have been, over the arc of the last year or so, a number of very powerful displays, also at the Library of Congress. And, you know, shout out to Carla Hayden, the first black person, period, but also a sister who is the Librarian of Congress. You see these stunning pictures of the suffragist movement and these marches. And at the Museum of American History, you see Ida Wells in this march, because Ida Wells is like, I'm not going to march with my sisters, who I am with 100%, but they are going to stay in the back. I'm not going to do that. And at the same time, that distinguishes her from other titans of the period, like Mary Church Terrell, who is a remarkable, formidable activist, intellectual, organizer, who takes a different tack, a bit of a different tactic. But Ida Wells would never be confined to a paradigm where her liberation struggle would be disaggregated in a way that didn't benefit the entire black community. And that's the lesson I think we can learn from today.
And so I want to touch on that point just a little bit more. Her refusing to march in the back. Also, when we were talking about her refusing to give up her seat in the railroad car, because I think it was a first class car.
Yes.
When they were asking her to move, and this is not even, was it even 100, I don't think about 100 years ago? I mean, it's not even that long ago. But
No, not at all, that's right.
But it was before Rosa Parks, and so.
Oh, no question.
The fact that in the 1890s that she was unwilling to move and that got in a fight with the people trying to remove her, that she had this fight in her that I will not be a second-class citizen.
No, absolutely right. You know, it's funny, Harriet Tubman, it's funny when we think about, you know, Jean, it's funny you mentioned this, when we think about how short a time that we're talking about. It's really stunning.
Right.
Let's think about this. Harriet Tubman passes away 1913, which means Harriet Tubman and Ida B. Wells overlap substantially. Mm. The march that we're talking about, the women's march, was March the 3rd, actually, 1913. It's the year Harriet Tubman passes away. So Ida Wells is busting this paradigm at the same time that Harriet Tubman is drawing her last breath, and in late 1912, Rosa Parks is born in Tuskegee, Alabama. So there's a brief window of time when Rosa Parks, Ida B. Wells, and Harriet Tubman are alive at the same time. Wow. One of them is a baby. And it's going to take another 42 years before Mrs. Parks tells that bus driver in Montgomery, yeah, I'm not getting up. But it just really kind of helps us understand that this relay race we're talking about in liberation struggle, we're talking about these black women who are involved in it, all this stuff is taking place in a small window of time. We're talking about decades, not millennia, not centuries, just decades. And as you say, the case on the Tennessee Railroad car, I think, is just one of the most inspirational cases. And, you know, our creative workers are people who are filmmakers and playwrights. This is one where I tell my students all the time, one of y'all, please make a movie where Ida Wells gets on his train, says, I'm going to read my newspaper. Ida bought a first class ticket. I don't like sitting in the segregated car because they smoke back there. And I just want to read my newspaper. I'm a journalist. I'm trying to read my paper. I'm trying to enjoy this small little ride. I paid my money. And when they come to put her off out of this car, because she wants to ride with dignity and she's paid her money, she bites the first guy.
Right.
Here comes the conductor, like, nah. And then when they come to forcibly eject her, she gets her feet hooked up under the seat in front of her, digs her hands in the top. And y'all, and mind you now, like Harriet Tubman, like Mrs. Parks, Ida Wells is small in stature, but like those other two, she's not to be trifled with. So eventually they have to physically evict her from this car. She turns around and sues. She gets a black lawyer. Again, she's for the race. The railroad company buys the black lawyer off. So she's got to get another lawyer. She sues again. Now, this is in the wake of the civil rights cases, what they call the civil rights cases, which in many ways attacked the Reconstruction amendments of a generation before. And so by 1875, the Supreme Court decides you can have segregated rail cars, a decision that 20 years later, they're really going to bring to the height in 1896 with Plessy versus Ferguson. So, but she still, Ida Wells, sues the railroad company and wins at the lowest court. Her victory is overturned on appeal, and she expresses disappointment. But to make the point, I think, that you're raising, you know, who is suing for rights and protesting segregation in transportation at this time in American history, two generations before the Montgomery bus boycott, two generations before the bus boycotts in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and the birth of what many people refer to as the modern civil rights movement, is Ida B. Wells Barnett in West Tennessee saying, I'm not gonna stand for this. And before she ever sets foot in a courtroom, she balls up her fist, opens her mouth and says, I will fight you literally before I fight you in court. It's a remarkable display of courage.
And I wanted to touch really quickly on her married life. And the reason is because she takes the name Wells Barnett, right? So she doesn't even just really even give up her full name.
Right.
One. And she had, I would say, like an equal relationship to her husband. And that was unheard of back then, that they had a working relationship with her husband, and also didn't completely change her name.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, it's funny, Jeannie, it's interesting. We're in 2020. So, of course, it's nothing for women and men or partners when they marry to retain their name in addition to their partner's name. It's hardly an afterthought now. But what many folks don't realize is this was a practice that black women pioneered in the 19th century. And people say, oh, I didn't know that. And all you have to do is go back and look at the most identifiable black women leaders of the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And you see they've all got their names and their husband's names. Mm. Mary McLeod Bethune, Mary Church Terrell, Ida B. Wells Barnett. Like, so black women have been doing this long before anybody else. So yeah, I love you. I'm going to take your name and add it to my name. So it's very important to understand. But the love story, the love affair between Ferdinand Barnett of Chicago and Ida Wells is triggered by the first thing we talked about. When Ida Wells tells people they need to leave Memphis after they lynched her friend and destroyed the People's Grocery, the white people in Memphis go off, and with law enforcement, they destroy her newspaper offices. She's traveling at the time. Ida Wells is like, okay, I see you. I'm coming back to Memphis. Her friends have to prevail on her. No, you cannot move back to Memphis. So what am I gonna do? Why don't you go to Chicago? And that's when you see a woman move to Chicago, and she meets Frederick Barnett, who's a lawyer, and they get married. In fact, you know, now here's, she's a first-rate journalist. He's a first-rate lawyer. They're a power couple, so to speak. But the announcement of their marriage, the event of their marriage, which happened in June 1895, June 27, 1895, was announced on page one of the New York Times. So it's very, wow. Exactly. I mean, you know, they talk about what the bridesmaids had on. They talk about this power couple being married. And of course, Ida Wells is a major figure in Black America, and her wedding is announced to America writ large, because mind you now, she's already been to England, so she's an international figure, and the two of them get married. Now, not only do they get married, they have a big family, and in another kind of gangster move for her time or this, she names one of the children Ida Bell Wells. So it's like she's okay, it's not conventional to name a junior, a woman naming a daughter junior, but what does she do? She virtually creates a junior in that family that she has. And mind you, she doesn't get married till she's 33 years old. In fact, for those who are listening, I would suggest that one of the most powerful books I've ever read was edited by a sister out of West Tennessee, Miriam DaCosta Willis. She found in the archives, edited and published, The Memphis Diary of Ida B. Wells. Ida B. Wells, when she, as I said, when she was in her early to late 20s, she was a school teacher in Memphis. And Ida Wells keeps a journal of what it means to be a black woman in the 1890s, making her way, 1880s, 1890s, making her way as a professional. She talks about everything from teaching to study, and then she really talks about relationships. She says, you know, this guy wanted to take me out, so he came calling, I went with him, but I'm afraid that he's intimidated because I know he liked the way I look, but as I was talking, it became apparent that perhaps I'm a little too educated, a little too worldly for this man, and maybe these men are not used to a woman like me. I mean, it's fascinating to see her do that. Mm. So, yeah, so when she found Frederick Lee Barnett, she found a man who was up to the wonderful opportunity to be a life partner with a woman of that kind of formidable intellect and drive.
Well, I want to bring her work forward to present day in terms of the anti-lynching work that she was doing. What are your thoughts on anti-lynching legislation happening today in 2020? Do you feel like it's still necessary, and just the fact that it took this long to even get anything remotely close to passing?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, of course, I'm glad that the legislation was proposed and passed. I also think that this is a political climate where it's easier to get something passed like that. And I think it speaks to a couple of underlying issues that we have to confront if we're being honest in this country. Let's, as you say, bring her work, bring Ida Wells's work forward to this moment, very succinctly by saying that Ida Wells was the champion of anti-lynching work from the late 19th century up to the first third of the 20th century. And she, as I said, she participated in the founding of the NAACP. And there was a senator, Leonidas Dyer, who pushed for an anti-lynching bill that was finally introduced. It passed the House of Representatives in 1922, but it died in the United States Senate because the Senate had these Southern segregationist senators who blocked every piece of anti-lynching legislation from the act that was introduced in 1922, the Dyer anti-lynching bill, all the way through the 1960s. But Ida Wells is not given the credit to this day that she deserves because in the wake of the formation of the NAACP, they took up anti-lynching as a central issue. And at the time of the work to get the Dyer anti-lynching bill passed, and in the wake of its defeat, the NAACP made anti-lynching one of its signature causes. And that cause was taken up, or kind of personified in some ways, by Walter White, the director of the NAACP, who took over the reins from the first black executive director, James Weldon Johnson, who had been an anti-lynching activist as well. Walter White published some very powerful books and publications around anti-lynching. Walter White, and you know, there's a reason why W.E.B. Du Bois called him White Walter, kind of derisively in some ways, but Walter White could have passed for white. And Walter White would often investigate lynchings after they had occurred. And when people would come and say, hey, there's a Negro around here asking about this lynching, only then would the people he had interviewed discover that he was black. Mm-hmm. So he showed some incredible courage. But sexism, infighting in that small group of black leadership, shut Ida Wells out of her due recognition of being the woman who in many ways lit the torch that became the anti-lynching movement. Now we fast forward over many decades of struggling for anti-lynching legislation, only to see it blocked by these segregationist senators and going forward. The main reason that anti-lynching legislation did not pass, at least the main stated reason beyond white supremacy, was that you had these fierce advocates of quote unquote states' rights. And their argument was the federal government could not interfere with the rights of states to punish people, and that range of right to punish would include the right to punish for racial violence. At the same time, the Supreme Court is really crafting out this theory of colorblind constitutionalism to really argue that even if someone has been deprived of their life or their liberty and they are black, you've got to demonstrate that they were deprived of that because they were black, which means you've got to meet an intent standard. You almost have to call somebody a racial epithet before you lynch them. And even if you do that, there are rulings at the Supreme Court level that say, well, that was personal animus. It wasn't really racial. And that all begins to change in the 1960s, the famous so-called Mississippi Burning case, United States versus Price, where you see two white civil rights workers and one black civil rights worker, the famous Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney case, where they are arrested, taken to the jail. The local deputy, Cecil Price, then lets them out of jail, but there's a commingled mob of sheriff's deputies and local citizens who then kill them. At that point, the Supreme Court says this egregious transgression is indeed state action. And because it is state action, it triggers the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution that says nobody should be deprived of life, liberty without equal due process of law or equal protection under the law. That provides a crack by which you can begin to prosecute at the federal level violence against people based on race. And that's where you begin to see some thawing in the court, in the case law. Still don't have anti-lynching legislation, though. So when you see Senator Cory Booker, Senator Kamala Harris, when you see the co-sponsors that sign on, introduce this on the Senate side and name it for Emmett Till, who, of course, is lynched in 1955 at Money, Mississippi, in August 1955. What you now see is legislation that certainly can be supported, even if it's just a symbolic kind of thing, which it absolutely is not, because lynching is still going on in many ways, racial terror, racial violence. And for people to understand, to lynch somebody means you've committed an act of violence against someone because of the group they're from, and you've committed it with other people. But it doesn't mean that you've killed them. It means you committed this act of violence. So you don't have to die in order to have been lynched. In fact, there's some famous examples, James Cameron being one famous person who they hung, but he survived. But he is a person who survived. He was lynched, but he survived. At any rate, when this legislation is introduced, and it's been passed by the House, anticipates being passed by the Senate, it's named for Emmett Till, but in a final irony, at least the draft of the bill that passed the House of Representatives, I hope the Senate, I guess now they just gotta work it out of committee. The organization that is named in pioneering is the NAACP, and the person that is named is Walter White. So we don't see Ida Wells' name, and I'm saying some congressional staffer, y'all couldn't figure out how to get Ida Bell Wells Barnett in this legislation that she was absolutely part of the group that struggled to get passed in the 20s, who, when she, by the time she passed away in the early 1930s, it still wasn't legislation. And in 2020, particularly when you've got women like Kamala Harris involved, and it shouldn't be circumscribed to women members of the national legislature, you know, it would have been nice to see Ida Wells' name in it.
We've been speaking with Associate Professor of Africana Studies and Chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University, Dr. Gregory Carr, as part of our Women's History Month Profiles in Excellence, about investigative journalist, abolitionist, and suffragist, and civil rights icon, Ida B. Wells. Dr. Carr, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Always a pleasure, and thank you for the honor for letting a man talk a little bit about these sisters. I appreciate you.
Yes, sir.
That's, again, a regular morning show called Upfront, but a special edition for Women's History Month. Ida B. Wells should have her name on that. It's pretty clear. That was the takeaway. I mentioned at the top her publication, which she has her street address on Clark Street, 128 South. Send 3 cents for postage, and she would send you this pamphlet she wrote. The Colored American is Not in the World Columbian Exposition, published at the time of the Columbian Exposition in Chicago, where everything was made out of paper mache and didn't last too long. It was all very white. Subtitled, The Afro-American's Contribution to Columbian Literature, which I guess was a category of the day, Hail Columbia. But it has chapters like lynch law, the convict lease system, class legislation, which doesn't describe it in today's terms, the progress of the Afro-American since emancipation, the reason why to the public. Some of those are not written by her. The introduction is, as I mentioned, written by Frederick Douglass. I found this fascinating when I stumbled on this. And now I know her husband, the lawyer Ferdinand Lee Barnett, was also contributed a chapter to this pamphlet. A little bit in French and German, cognizant of the international audience. All right, there's a lot of events going on. One that Jason Finkelman has a little bit association with, lecture and performance gateways to world music, music traditions of Southern Africa. This is this afternoon at 1 to 2. So visiting scholar with, through the Center for Advanced Studies. This one is written without her name up front. Kara Stacey, who is from Johannesburg, I believe. She's going to do a presentation perspective on traditional music production. She's also preoccupied with water and drought, and somehow that fits in her presentation. Tomorrow night, 37th Annual International Dinner and Performance at the YMCA. It's a fundraiser. Check your local sources of information for the amount, etc. It is at 6 p.m., supper time for some. A lot of musical offerings tonight as well. Something out at the Polinatarium, little building that's been converted to look like a big beehive, commercial kind of looking thing. And that's ongoing this afternoon, I believe, 2 p.m., kicking it off. So a variety of offerings around town. The Blues Deacons, the Painkillers, and the Data Waves all playing the same time. So if I have the energy, there's a choice involved. Okay, just enough time, I think, to get on this next segment. Another story I don't think you'll hear anywhere else. I did play this as I had a little extra time during the Friday Farm segment and got most of it on. I think I should be able to get all of it on. This is from another producer. She's from KPFK in L.A., Sonali Kalhatar. I found her originally when she was an activist. She had a thing called Afghan Women's Mission. I thought she was Afghani, but she's subcontinental Indian, if you will. She was on pregnancy leave for a while, has a young child. I don't know why I threw that in. Missed her for a bit. She'll tell you where she's available. It's a great morning show out of the left coast. Very early in the morning, her time, I think. And there's this project around the world looking at the way right-wing dominionist Christianity is affecting reproductive autonomy, if you will. Some people call it a euphemism when I use it. Other people say, well, that's a better expression, isn't it? I appreciate that.
Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. While many of us are familiar with right-wing Christian evangelical efforts to undermine women's reproductive rights here in the United States, an insidious network of American-run clinics worldwide has been found to be pushing their anti-abortion message. A new investigation by Open Democracy found that organization called Heartbeat International, linked to Donald Trump, based in Ohio, operates so-called crisis pregnancy centers in 18 different countries. Journalists went undercover for this first-of-its-kind investigation and found that such centers were spreading misinformation and outright lies in order to deter women from having abortions. We go now to Mexico City to speak with Isabella Cota. She is a journalist focused on finance and investigative reporting. She was a correspondent for Reuters and Bloomberg News in the United Kingdom, Costa Rica, and in her native Mexico. Before becoming independent, she's worked with Quinto Elemento Lab, and her work has been published in The Guardian, The Independent, Univision, and Business Week, among others. And her story on open democracy is entitled Revealed, U.S. Linked anti-abortion centers lie and scare women across Latin America. It's part of the broader story called Trump-linked religious extremists target women with disinformation worldwide. Welcome to the program, Isabella.
Hi, Sonali. Thank you for having me.
So can you first give us an overview of the bigger story before we focus on your part of it? I understand that you and other journalists essentially went undercover at these crisis pregnancy centers around the world.
That's correct. Open Democracy got a network of reporters in 18 different countries to really look into these crisis pregnancy centers, as they are known in the United States, and really nail down what it is exactly that they are telling women. So I was one of these reporters across the world. We all went undercover. We presented ourselves with the story as raising an unwanted pregnancy. We wanted to know our options. Most of these centers, although not all of them, advertised online or in some way as a center that actually provided abortions. So, you know, it was understandable to expect to show up at one of these centers already feeling like you were going to get the abortion done. And in reality, what we faced was emotional manipulation and lies, very different kinds of lies across the world. Among our main findings, we found reporters were told that getting an abortion could increase your risk of cancer, that one of them suggested, didn't say outright, but they suggested that your partner could turn gay if you have an abortion, that our reporter in Costa Rica in Central America was told that she could get cerebral palsy from an abortion. It was just all different kinds of terrible, terrible lies. Me personally, in the two centers that I went to in Mexico City, I was told, among other things, that 30% of women who get an abortion suffer a serious complication from it. And that includes the perforation of the uterus or hemorrhage or the perforation of of intestines, which is a complete lie. The rate is lower than 1%, depending on where you are in the world.
So that means at least 99% of abortions are safe.
Yes. I mean, generally speaking, it really does depend on where you have the abortion done in the world, but the rate is of around 1%. And they said 30%. They also told me that if I suffered any complication from an abortion, whether medical or not, that no hospital would treat me, which is a lie. By law in Mexico, hospitals have to treat anyone that comes in to the emergency room. And they also told me, they showed me fake consent forms that asked for either a relative or the father of, I guess not the father, but the partner of the woman to sign for their consent for the woman to get an abortion, which is really, really serious. Any woman, if we can imagine the case of a 17-year-old who perhaps got pregnant through a rape or even just by accident, who doesn't really know her rights, and she ends up in one of these centers, she's being told that she needs consent, and that's totally going to dissuade her from making decisions on her own body. And this is what they're telling women in Mexico.
So the such crisis pregnancy centers have been operating in the United States. There's hundreds, maybe thousands of them around the country. We know about them. They use language that's sympathetic to pregnant women, pregnant people who might be concerned about what to do, might be considering an abortion, who might be lured in by their language, who go in only to find that they're essentially talked out of it, or presented with information that's suggestive of being, you know, unbiased, but is, of course, extremely biased. So are these crisis pregnancy centers in the U.S. A precursor to what is now spread worldwide? Are they linked? Are they part of the same trend?
That is an excellent, excellent question. And I really hope that viewers and listeners of your show can go online and check if these centers are operating in their state, because what we have seen from this first mapping out of these operations that Open Democracy has done is that their operations really vary from where they are. We know that these crisis pregnancy centers started in the 70s around Roe versus Wade as a response to this reproductive freedom that women were given. We know that in some states, they receive questionable funds, perhaps from even the government, the local government. But it really does depend on where they are. What we did at Open Democracy is basically take this wealth of information that we have of these centers in the United States and try to figure out how much of this is done outside of the country. We found very different experiences, but fundamentally, they're doing the same thing. They are lying to women, or they are manipulating women in order to dissuade them from getting an abortion. How they do it might differ significantly, but fundamentally, the goal and the actions are the same.
So let's talk specifically about what you found. I understand that your article, which is part of this broader study, focuses on Latin America, Mexico, and Ecuador and Argentina included. Where did you do your work, and how? What has the response been to the study showing what these crisis pregnancy centers are doing?
So I'm going to start with where the sort of the investigation in Latin America started, and that was in the tax filings of these two organizations. Two U.S. organizations called Heartbeat International and Human Life International, because they are foundations or NGOs, they have to report in their tax filings whether they spend money abroad. Heartbeat International has reported in its tax filings that they work closely and partly finance centers across Latin America that operate out of Mexico called CAM. It's Centro de Ayuda para la Mujer, so CAM, that's short for CAM. So we started looking into these camps. Me personally, I started looking into where these centers are in Mexico, but I ended up finding a bunch of places across Latin America, which is a giant, giant region where they also operate. So on my first part of this operation, I added up the amount of money that they've spent since 2007 and found that these two organizations combined have spent $2.2 million in the region. Separately, I reached out along with Diana Gariboni, who is the editor and also a reporter on the story, who is based in South America. We found reporters that could go to these centers. So we had reporters go to centers in Argentina, Ecuador, Costa Rica, and Mexico City. I went to Mexico City. Now, what I found, particularly here, which is a very interesting case because in Mexico City, abortion is legal under any reason before week 12 of the pregnancy. What I found is that they advertise online with photos of doctors with stethoscopes and lab coats, and they advertise themselves as specialists on medical abortions. But when in fact, when you get to the place, there's nothing that says this is a clinic. There's no doctors. There are no lab coats. It's like a makeshift bed with a TV. And in one of the centers, there was an ultrasound machine. I was very aggressively told that I was killing my baby, that I shouldn't kill my baby because my baby only had me. I was asked for my partner's information, contact information, which I refused to give. I was told that even if my parents kicked me out of the house, that I would be able to survive, but and that I should still have a baby. I was offered an ultrasound by a person who admitted that she was not a doctor. And she also offered me post-abortion syndrome therapy, psychological therapy, in case I decided to have an abortion. What I found particularly disturbing is that in Mexico City, you could walk into any public clinic and ask for an abortion, and they have to provide it to you by law.
And that's quite progressive compared to the U.S.
Very progressive. I mean, Mexico City is kind of like the exception to the rule of Latin America, really. It's one of the most progressive cities in the region. And these women in these centers refused to give me any real information on where I could actually get an abortion. This is very dangerous. I really hope that listeners and viewers of your show can understand that a woman who is pregnant, who is considering an abortion, needs to have all the right information at hand to make the best decision. You can't ask a woman to go to a separate center without giving her guidance to where to go and how it works, because it might just put her pregnancy at risk and her life. So this is in a nutshell what we found. I mean, one of the most disturbing aspects of this, of course, and as you mentioned before, are that these two organizations have political ties to the Trump administration. Heartbeat International, in particular, was founded by a separate investigative group years ago to have been working with the U.S. government by diverting migrant minors who wanted to get an abortion or who were pregnant. They were diverted off to Heartbeat International. So that means that the Trump administration and one of these organizations has worked closely. And this is extremely important. These organizations are emboldened, they are empowered, and now we're seeing the consequences beyond the U.S. border.
I want to play for our audience an excerpt of a video created by Open Democracy about the broader investigation so that we can hear from some of the women themselves about what they were told at these crisis pregnancy centers.
Les dije que estaba considerando abortar. Me hicieron ver un video sobre cómo, si me hago un aborto médico, puedo morir.
They told me that terminating a pregnancy will have severe implications for my health.
I was trained to tell women that if they had an abortion, they were more likely to abuse their other children, they could die, and their partner could turn gay.
They say they offer pregnant women advice. They often look like medical clinics or counseling services. But in fact, many are run by activists who try to talk women out of having abortions, and often from accessing contraception too. There are thousands of these centers in the US, but now we've discovered they've spread all over the world. They're backed by a powerful American lobby group, Heartbeat International. Heartbeat claims close links to the Trump administration. In centers across 18 countries, we found extraordinary distortions and manipulation. We were told things like abortion increases cancer risks, condoms don't work, hospitals will refuse to treat medical complications. All of this is false.
Me dijeron que si quería abortar, necesitaba el consentimiento firmado del hombre que me embarazó.
And that is a short excerpt from a video created by Open Democracy as part of the investigation, first of its kind investigation, to so-called crisis pregnancy centers run by a U.S. organization in 18 different countries. My guest is Isabella Cota. She is one of the journalists who participated in this investigation, specifically focusing on Latin America. So I understand that some lawmakers in some Latin American countries are just now understanding the extent of this problem. What are some of the things that they have suggested to counter this misinformation?
So this is very interesting. The reaction by lawmakers, government officials, and even activists across Latin America has been mostly not just outrage, but a call to action. In Mexico, for example, just as an example, I spoke to a senator, Patricia Mercado, who pointed to the fact that they seem to be operating, at least in Mexico, in some kind of a loophole because their advertising is confusing and misleading enough not to be regulated under the health ministry, and therefore they kind of can get away with it. So she called for a campaign of true information across the country so that women don't end up in these centers. We have, for example, lawmakers in Ecuador saying that they have to be investigated and action needs to be taken. The same goes for Argentina. Lawmakers and government officials are calling for some kind of action so that these centers cannot keep operating as they are currently. In Mexico City, I spoke to the health minister of the city, who is a woman, Oliva Lopez. She said that they received some citizen complaints regarding misinformation of these types of centers and that an investigation would take place. But she really felt short in whether there's going to be a sanction, whether there has been a sanction, or what kind of a sanction these centers could face. From my perspective, Sonali, as the reporter in charge of looking at all this information in the region, I feel like there's still not enough, I don't want to say a reaction or political will, but perhaps a lack of unity in the different governments. You have certain people calling out to action so that this stops, but we don't have everyone coming out and saying this needs to stop. And so we're hoping that now that this information has been exposed, that there might be more organization, better organization in the different governments for much larger, more impactful action.
On Heartbeat International's website, they explain, this is an organization that runs these crisis pregnancy centers that's linked to the Trump administration and is supported by them, or they claim support by them. They are saying that that they provide just information from seeing the flutter of the heartbeat on her first ultrasound to teaching parenting classes or coordinating an adoption plan and providing material aid throughout the pregnancy and beyond. We offer compassionate support so that no woman ever feels that abortion is her only option. She mentioned the ultrasound situation. This is something that U.S. Right-wing lawmakers have pushed in states around the United States, where basically they have mandated in some cases that doctors have to do ultrasounds. The so-called heartbeat bills are based on that as well. Is this the kind of information that they're suggesting women need to have before they decide on an abortion?
Perhaps. I mean, that could be the case. In reaction to our story specifically, Heartbeat stands by, they said that they stand by their training programs and their training material, because as far as we understand, and this might be a bit different, the Heartbeat International is in a way training and helping the people working outside of the United States run these centers. So there could be some things that the women in these, the staff at these centers are doing outside of the Heartbeat's their type of care protocol or their guidelines. But there are other things that they could be advised to do directly that they're just following instructions. So there's a bit of a gray area there. All we do know for a fact is that some of the things that the reporters face around the world are the same things that women in the United States in Heartbeat International centers have been told exactly. And for that, we tie directly the training and the information to Heartbeat International.
Where does this organization get its funding? I mean, if it's running centers both in the United States and in 18 different countries around the world, they must be, you know, they must have pretty deep pockets.
Yes, the short answer to that is, well, donations. Just like any foundation or a non-governmental organization, they have donors who are aligned with their values, who provide them with funds every year to conduct their activities. Some states, for example, in the global story, we talk about Florida, in which it's possible that Florida state funds have been going to this organization. But as I said before, it's really difficult to tell exactly how this operates in the different states in the United States. We do know for a fact, based on their tax filings, that wherever they're getting their money, some of it is flowing out to Latin America and some of it is flowing out to the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm. Isabella, let's also finally talk about what grassroots efforts there might be to counter this push, because, you know, those, even a country like Mexico, which has much more progressive policies on women's access to abortion compared to the U.S., if such centers are allowed to operate under the radar, if you will. I imagine that the news of what you've done has sparked people to come forward, those who are pro-abortion activists, pro-choice activists, to do some, you know, to counter this in a grassroots way, to counter it with real information. Because, of course, what these centers seem to be doing is operating on pretty strong sense of ignorance and pushing ignorance, pushing misinformation. So what are some measures beyond legislative to counter them?
Well, all feminist collectives, I mean, I'll speak about Latin America specifically because it's the region that I've been looking at more closely. When it comes to grassroots movements, Latin America really has seen the flourishment of a bunch of feminist organizations across the region. We have had the abortion debate happening in Argentina, for example, in recent years, which sparked the Green Handkerchief movement, which is now ubiquitous across the entire region, just as an example. So when it comes to grassroots efforts, it's really going to come down to these organizations taking this information and making sure that they start a campaign of their own to give women the actual true information that they need to make the right decision. So we haven't seen this happening explicitly yet, but we are hoping that this information, as it's the first time it's been out in this manner, mapped in this way, will make women organize better in their individual countries and start campaigns to inform women with the real information that they need.
And Isabella, is opendemocracy.net the best place for people to find a link to the work that you and your fellow journalists have done on the story?
That's correct. Yes. Opendemocracy.net is the main website of the organization. This has been done under the 50-50 project, which is a gender-focused project. But you can find all of the links on opendemocracy.net as well as our social media, Open Democracy.
And we'll link to both your piece and the broader piece from our website directly as well. Thank you so much for joining us today and good luck to you.
Thank you, Sonali, and thank you for having me and your listeners for taking a good listen.
My guest has been Isabella Cota. She's a journalist focused on finance and investigative reporting. We've been discussing her story for Open Democracy entitled Revealed, U.S.-linked anti-abortion centers lie and scare women across Latin America. It's part of a broader story called Trump-linked religious extremists target women with disinformation worldwide. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes, and now Spotify.
Okay, Sonali Kolhatkar, another difficult subject. It is just hitting 11. The opinions you hear here are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others here at the station. It's time now for Behind the News, something on corruption at the UAW. That'll be difficult listening too. What was the other subject? Well, he'll be telling you, oh, it's with the kind of conservative Andrew Bacevich, who I think is linked with a new think tank that had some interesting possibilities. Still avoiding the word statecraft.